welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Amanda Hayes. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Anna. Hello, everyone.
And this week we've been reading Humankind by Rutger Bregman. But first, book news, and the Nobel Prize for Literature has been announced after they had a bumpy couple of years where they didn't award the prize one year, and then last year there were two awards and one of them was controversial, I think. And so this year they've awarded the prize to Louise Gluck, who's a poet from America. So she's 77, a already highly awarded poet. She's won numerous awards, including a Pulitzer. She's been the poet laureate in the United States. I haven't read her, but apparently quite autobiographical, but also blending classical myth and quite austere language. And Colm Tóibín wrote a beautiful article where he praised her for being brave and truthful. And I think truth and honesty is always the marks of the, you know, the best writers have a real honesty in their writing, don't they? But he also talked about how she harnesses the power of the unfinished, which I really loved.
And
that she has praised other poets for being masters of white, of negative space, and that she herself has that ability to leave it just slightly unfinished. And she's spoken about she doesn't like a poem that's too complete and that is sealed up.
So she wants to challenge her readers from the sounds of it.
She likes that little bit of uncertainty and room in the poem. So I really like the sound of that. So
Sounds challenging, I have to say.
Yes, but I will try to read hers, I think. So that's Louise Gluck. And the Booker Prize, we've mentioned the shortlisted books in a previous episode, but the winner will be announced on the 19th of November, and the Booker Prize have announced a series of events leading up to it. I think because of the unusual times that we're in, they normally have a series of live events with shortlisted authors and so on, and they can't do that this year. But I think they're going to live stream some events so we can tune in. People that wouldn't ordinarily, who are not in London or wouldn't ordinarily be able to go, I think we'll be able to tune in. And it's on BBC Live or BBC Arts. They're also doing some regional events. So it's actually interesting how it broadens the audience in some ways, being able to do these things. Even though we're a bit zoomed out and we don't necessarily want to see it on a screen, it does mean people from anywhere in the world can tune in.
Yeah, I think that's been something that's come out of one of the silver linings, I would say, of the COVID-19 pandemic, this broader extent to which people can reach their audiences.
And now on to our book of the week. So we've been reading Humankind by Rutger Bregman. And Rutger Bregman is a Dutch writer. He's a popular historian and he writes on history, philosophy and economics. One of his previous books is Utopia for Realists, How We Can Build the Ideal World. And that was a bestseller. He's got quite a high profile. He's been described as the Dutch wunderkind of new ideas. And he also has a well-known TED talk on poverty. And so he's very popular and still young. So
he's only 32.
Another one of these authors that makes us feel so underachieving. Yeah. But, you know, just to be admired, I think. And Humankind is his latest book. It's called Humankind, A Hopeful History. And the premise of the book is he's taking this idea that humans are essentially selfish and governed by self-interest. That leads to all sorts of, you know, outcomes, including war and conflict. And he's turning that around. He's really examining that and looking at evidence about that. And his proposition is that humans are essentially good on the whole, with some exceptions, and inclined to cooperate, and that there are evolutionary reasons for that. And so it's a really provocative idea, and as it says on the tin, you know, a hopeful idea. And he's going back over history and turning some of these examples where humans have acted badly up to the light to see, well, is that evidence that we're all bad or we're all sort of selfish, or is it actually, was it one person coercing others to do that, for example? So he starts with the philosophers Hobbes and Rousseau and that old, age-old question of are we basically good or evil, and are we basically selfish and we need laws to govern us when we're all together in a society? You know, do we need a strong government to keep us in line? The sort of Hobbes, life is nasty, brutish and short, and all the Rousseau more idealistic, you know.
The noble savage idea.
Yeah, are we more noble than that? So he starts from that sort of point and then talks about the book The Lord of the Flies, because that is the sort of example that we all have, I suppose, by William Golding, of what happens when we are left to our own devices as the classic, you know, boys, I think 9 or 10 of them left on an island to their own devices, and it ends in conflict and violence and chaos and death ultimately, plot spoiler. And he actually examines that, and this was fascinating because there are two things that I found really interesting. One, William Golding himself was depressed and was writing from a melancholy sort of point of view and had a bleak outlook, pessimistic outlook on life generally, and that infused that work. And two, Rutger Bregman looks at a real life case of boys being trapped on an island.
It was Atta Island, I think.
Was it Atta Island? Yeah. What actually happened when that real life case happened? And it was fascinating. And there was actually, in that case, the boys cooperated, they governed themselves, they worked out how to produce food and so on. So it's really interesting going beneath the myth of what we expect from people. Then he looks at other, I suppose his approach is, he has that proposition, he tells you enough to be quite convincing, and then he looks at the but what about questions. Yeah. So when then we would say, but what about war, you know, what about World War II, for example, what about crime, what about terrorism? And then he examines that. So for example, that the Milgram experiment, which was at the same time as Hannah Arendt was writing her essay, which included that phrase, the banality of evil, and that idea that anyone is capable of committing evil. And he goes behind the scenes of that and examines that and says, well, actually, it's more likely to be, you know, there could be a psychopath or one sociopath, one evil person, but for the general person to be committing an evil act, they often need to be coerced into doing that and threatened and bullied before they will do it. It's not something they're instinctively doing. And of course, the reason he posits is that in evolutionary terms, if we don't cooperate and if we don't trust the other people around us, we wouldn't survive, because generally, especially in the past, we'd face threats of, they might have been more wild threats of animals and things like that. And as a society, you would have to be able to trust that you're all in it together.
Yeah.
And someone's keeping watch, someone's asleep, someone's getting food. And if that falls down, then you don't survive as a species. So it's very interesting. What did you think, Amanda?
I thought it was fascinating and a really provocative book to read because, as Anna says, he takes a lot of sort of commonplace ideas and really challenges them. I absolutely love the message of the book, that humans are essentially good, and I fervently want to believe that. Some of the things he said that I found really interesting were that he talks about we are what we believe, and so an example he gives of that is the placebo effect. If we believe that humans are evil, we find what we're looking for. So he's saying if we all believe that humans are good, that will ultimately lead to a better society. So I like the way he frames that. And another point he makes on that front is that the news is really bad for us watching the news, because it basically reports all the negative things happening in the world. And if you watch the news, it kind of presents this view of the world.
Picture.
Yeah, and it's a bit out of context. It's like the exceptional things that are happening that are negative. But because you see that, for a lot of people every day, it feels like it's quite pervasive.
Yeah, it's quite a skewed version of life, isn't
exactly.
it? Because if you live in a city and a million people, you know, 999,000 are going about their day peacefully.
Yes.
You'll read about the burglary that happened, or the, you know, the the event that was out of that ordinary.
Absolutely.
And that will give you a skewed vision of, you know, humans being a bit violent or aggressive, yeah, or, you know.
There's one quote in there, and I might not get this exactly right, but it's something like, news is for the mind like sugar is for the body. It's kind of addictive, yeah, and
junky.
Junky, not good for you. Having said that, there are a few things about the book that didn't sit all that well with me, and I think the way he was approaching it was almost a little bit black and white. It's like you either take the Hobbesian view that we're kind of evil, there's a thin veneer that covers of civility that covers us but scratch it a little bit and we're all brutes, or you take the Jean-Jacques Rousseau view, which is that we're kind of noble and good and will cooperate, and he clearly argues in favour of the latter. I think what's not explained in the book from my point of view was, if that is the case, how come there's been so many horrific genocides in the world, like Hitler's an obvious example, Pol Pot in Cambodia, because...
Yeah, it must be more nuanced than one or the other.
I think so, because if we were all essentially good and you have, you know, a few outliers, a few evil people, if they came up with an evil idea and everyone else around them is good, it wouldn't take root.
Yes.
But then someone like a lot of them, there were 6 million Jews were, you know, murdered during the Holocaust, and that relied on... largely on the general population to help sort of oil the machine, I guess, for them. And you can sort of explain away, look, the ordinary German, they were subject to propaganda, and there's all these reasons you can formulate as to why they may have acted in a, you know, fairly evil manner.
If they didn't think it was evil.
Yeah, if they didn't think it was evil. But there are still people at the top driving all this activity.
Well, my understanding of how he explained that was... that yes, despite his theory that people are generally good and want to cooperate and that there's an evolutionary basis, despite that theory, of course there'll be exceptions to that, and you will have your psychopaths and you have your Hitlers in any society, and that his theory was that they then coerce people to do evil on their behalf, and that people, say, in Germany who were reporting or who were actually the soldiers are doing that on threat of death, basically, or on threat of violence being done to them. And I think it's possibly something in between where, yes, they're coerced into it, but also perhaps some of them, whether because they've been persuaded by the propaganda or because they're weaker in their own self and they're in... you know, susceptible to influence, perhaps start to believe in it themselves and start to behave badly just of their own accord. I think, you know, it might be something in between. And that was some of the experiments that he looked into. Was it the Stanford prison experiment or the Milgram experiment?
I think Stanford prison experiment was the one where people, some acted as guards and some as prisoners.
Yeah.
And the Milgram experiment was administering the electric shock.
That was the electric shock. And on the face of it, when you read about it, it was... that people were willing to administer electric shocks to people. But when he talked to the people who'd done it, they had to be sort of bullied into it.
Yes.
They sort of said, no, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to hurt this person. And they had to be almost forced to do it. And that was his theory expanding, you know, into sort of Germany 1940s, that people were essentially had someone over their shoulder.
Yeah.
Persuading them or coercing them to toe the line.
There's one quote in the little section in the book that I thought was really instructive, and to me this kind of maybe sums up what people are like. And he says, an old man says to his grandson, "There's a fight going on inside me. It's a terrible fight between two wolves. One is evil, angry, greedy, jealous, arrogant and cowardly. The other is good. Peaceful, loving, modest, etc., etc. The two wolves are also fighting within you and inside every other person too." After a moment, the boy asks, "Which wolf will win?" The old man says, "The one you feed." So I think that's probably an interesting way of looking at human nature as well, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly it.
It is, but I guess the thing is, at the end of the day, if most people are decent and want to do the right thing, there's got to be a point at which you're not coerced. Like, you can stand up against it. I mean, I don't know. These are just some of the things I struggled with in the book.
And that is the really tricky thing, and the fascinating thing about when, I suppose, when it's a regime, not just an isolated person. And that he talks about how in the past, you know, there was this understanding we're all connected and we're all interconnected, and the societies were smaller, and so there was that real need for cooperation. Looking back at hunter-gatherer sort of societies, but now that we've settled with big populations, big cities, and from the sort of industrial revolution, private property, farming, and those sort of changes, it has dissipated, I suppose, that evolutionary need to cooperate, because we live differently now. And so you do have, if a leader is inclined towards violence or evil, that's on a much bigger scale, and that's where it is very hard. It's hard to turn that tide back, isn't it?
Yeah, the turning point, as he sees it, in the way humans have acted towards one another has been with private property and farming, because whereas in the past hunter-gatherers would roam about according to their needs, there wasn't that sense of private ownership. And once private ownership came in, it was people wanted to defend what they thought was rightfully theirs. And that's kind of where some of, I guess,
different attitudes crept in.
We kind of took, in his view, a bit of a misstep.
Yes.
I thought that was a really interesting observation.
Yeah, that's right. And I loved some of the positive case studies that he gave. And he looks at humans and the way he says humans crave togetherness and connection, and that they want to be part of something bigger. There's a holistic nature to it, and want to be connected with and part of nature. And he says humans are born to learn, bond and play, and so that's why we have eye contact. So he talks about other animals don't make eye contact with each other.
They don't have whites in their eyes, which means you can't focus on where someone's eyes are looking. And the other thing he does is he compares, when he talks about the evolution, he compares humans to chimpanzees and looks at various different aspects. But the thing that sets humans apart is social learning.
Yes.
So that's learning from one another, teaching each other, helping each other.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then he talks about that in the context of schools, and has some really good thoughts about if you could put that into practice more with schools, in terms of playing and that sense of cooperation. And he goes to the prison.
Oh, that was brilliant. That was fascinating. The prison in Norway.
Yes, of course it was Norway.
Yeah.
Has to be Scandinavia, doesn't it? But something that, you know, sounds progressive, and there was a bit more freedom to it.
And I think the philosophy was different. It was, instead of locking up criminals and keeping them away from society and using the prisons as an instrument of punishment, the philosophy behind this particular prison in Norway was, okay, we need to get these people to a point where they can function properly in society.
Yeah.
So locking them away with nothing to do isn't really going to,
no,
you know, prepare them for,
no,
in quotes, release back into the real world.
And
whereas
much more likely to end up back in prison.
To reoffend. Yeah, exactly. And in Norway, the way they, at this particular prison, they are getting them to a point where they can, you know, function as a good citizen.
And that's based on that principle of trusting that people want, you know, believing in the good in people, I suppose. And it sounds very warm and fuzzy, but actually he looks at the cost saving that has led to, because then Norway, they must have done it for long enough to have produced some good data, and they can show that the cost of keeping them in prison versus having a productive member of working member of society, and they've got enough data now to show that it's saved the government money.
Yeah.
So it's not, it's a, there's an economic basis for it. Partly
because the rate of reoffending is so much lower.
Yeah. And of course there would be exceptions where that might not work and so on and so forth. But if you applied that idea more and earlier on in life, as so you'd prevent some of those instances of crime in the first place, you're much more likely to get better results. So it's I don't know. The thing that I kept thinking about was game theory, because in game theory is, you're playing a game, do you follow the rules or do you cheat? And if you both follow the rules, then you might win. If you follow the rules and the other player cheats, they'll win. And so if you think they're going to cheat, then you cheat as well. I feel like that applies a bit here, because it's all well and good that you're doing the right thing and you're trusting and you're believing in the good. And then if you're on a government level, if you're dealing with a Putin, for example, and you're reading about some of the cases with the Litvinenko poisoning and the way the British government handled that, thinking, just not believing some of the things that Russia might have done and sort of being given a cassette. Yes, this is the cassette that's the evidence of X, and then taking it back to England without even listening to it and then realizing it was a blank cassette. That just, when you're dealing with someone that's not playing by those rules, it leaves you at such a disadvantage. Yes. And I think that's where I think a lot of people, especially on that government stage, that government level, are a bit more cynical because they believe they have to be. Which is unfortunate. When you read this book, you wish they didn't have to be. But
the other point he makes that I think nearly everyone can relate to is, in your small inner circle, you believe that the people you associate with are good, and they generally are. You expand it out little by little. Your neighbours are generally good, the community, your school community, your sports club. And there's a point at which that stops, and someone you don't know, a complete stranger, you may assume the worst about someone else.
Which is evolutionary, isn't it?
But what he's saying is, we just need to expand our borders a bit more, or our circles, so we assume that people are generally good.
Yes, and that was interesting.
Yeah, and I like as a way of being in this world, I think I really like that.
Yeah, that was he was looking at what about prejudice and in its extreme form, terrorism and conflict, but it starts with people not trusting people who are different to them.
Yeah.
And so of course he has to look at that, because that seems to fly in the face of what he's saying. But he says, again, there's an evolutionary basis, and what the solution for that is having contact with people who are different, because then you realise they're just as likely to be good as, those closer to home. And he said, for example, in the Brexit vote in the UK, which was where they voted to leave the European Union, and partly there was a prejudice element in that vote of people just not trusting people from other backgrounds and so on, and just wanting to keep England very English and very white. But he said, actually, the people in, say, central London, who have the most contact with immigrant communities, voted to stay because they're not afraid of that, because that's something they deal with in their everyday. So they've overcome that prejudice, whereas it's people who actually had hardly any immigrants in their communities that are the most frightened. And that's an example of...
Yeah, that's a good example.
He says too, the solution is to widen your... to travel and to widen your sort of sphere of friends, I suppose.
Because at the end of the day, I mean, I always think it's just an accident of birth or circumstances, You could have been living in a different country surrounded by different people who would be your friends and would be, decent people. But the fact that you don't know them doesn't mean you should put barriers up. Yeah. Unless there's a good reason to, I guess.
Yes. But, I thought that was a really, really positive message.
Yeah, that was kind of my favourite message of the book, I think.
Yeah, so a really interesting book. I recommend it. I was hesitant to start it because it's quite chunky.
Yes.
And it's non-fiction, so you think I have to get my serious hat on. But actually, it's really engaging. He writes very well, and it's those the examples move along quickly and keep you interested, and
there are lots of good anecdotes and stories in there.
Yeah, so that's Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And next week, Annie and I will be back with, we're going to read a short story from Nudie Branch, and that is Grace Jones, which won, I think, the Kane Prize this year. Cool. I'm just doing this by memory. I could be wrong. In the meantime, you can rate and review us on iTunes. That would be great. That helps people find the podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go and email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Litzy at A Bailey Karras. And Amanda, we won't see you for a while.
Yes, I'm having a bit of a break to focus on my wellbeing podcast for a while.
Yes, so that is for listeners, Amanda's Wellbeing
Podcast.
Love it. Yes. Yeah. So that's, and you can follow Amanda at Amanda L. Hayes 99.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And keep up with that one. So that's it from us. We will see you next week. Bye for now.
Bye.